From the team at CTS, this is the Train Ride Podcast, our show for endurance athletes who want to learn how to train more effectively and improve their performance. I'm Coach Adam Pulford, your host for the cycling edition of the show, where it's my job to interview top coaches, scientists, experts, and athletes in the world of cycling to bring you actionable training tips that you can apply to your own training. Now, let's dive into the show and learn how you can train right. As we get organized about this episode today, like, it's going to be very casual compared to some of the other episodes I've done in the past, and even what Coley has probably done in the past, where he drills down like real deep into some specific stuff. And you know, we always use the term super nerd out about stuff. We'll still do some of the nerding out, but I've picked a few topics that are just going to be like more kind of fast paced, getting Coley's thoughts on stuff, and I'll chime in. And I'm kind of going to call it like current events for the endurance community, if you will.
I like that. Yeah. And I want your thoughts on a lot of these topics too, because I know you've got some, and you know, I've got half formed thoughts on some of these things. And so I think this will be a good discussion. Hey. I'm looking forward to it. It'll be very Joe Rogan, possibly.
Oh gosh. Well,
not in some ways, in the long conversation way. Yes.
I love it. Yeah. And I've been wanting to do, you know, an episode like this or more episodes of this, because the feedback I get from our listeners too is just like, you know, I love the huge context and going deep, but like make them a little shorter, make them concise, and give a few thoughts. So I think like we'll, on the Train Right podcast, we'll aim to balance out some of the lengthy discussions with some of the timely and more poppy stuff. But, that being said, I think the number one thing that I'm going to ask you, Coley, first of all, is in regard to RPE. And that stands for rate of perceived effort or exertion, kind of depending on what you're reading, what you're looking at. But I've been talking to my athletes a little bit more, kind of at the start of the year anyway, like January and February, and just bringing more context to, okay, remember that tempo feels like a 7 out of 10 and threshold feels more like an 8, maybe 9 out of 10, this kind of stuff. So, but you also posted a meme yesterday. So let's start there with
RPE. If you want to see the meme, you can go check it out at Empirical Cycling on Instagram. I'm almost at 2,000 followers. Hey, let's get it going.
Get them up above 2,000, like the meme. But tell us about that meme.
I don't know what to do with all the followers anyway. So the meme, it's, you know, the four brain meme, you know, of the increasing enlightenment. Yeah. So the joke is, well, I'll explain the joke in a second. Well, you'll get the joke anyway. So it starts with, you know, with the regular brain is riding to RPE. The slightly more enlightened brain is riding to heart rate. The even more enlightened brain is riding to power. The ultimate enlightened brain is riding to RPE. And the joke obviously is that you started in the right spot all along, but on the way you actually learn to use these tools, because somebody in the comments was like, hey, I actually find RPE to be really helpful, but you know, if we use it in conjunction with heart rate and power, it's even more powerful. And I completely agree. But, you know, the meme can't really go into all that level of nuance because it's a meme, you know? and I actually wrote a journal article on this in a medical journal about injury that my friend and empirical cycling client invited me to write. And I kind of go into this. And then more recently, I saw an article on UAE coach using like a 3-minute FTP effort along with RPE and heart rate and whatnot to gauge how a rider's feeling. And I didn't know there was a name for this thing, and I've forgotten what the name is, but it's something like that is so useful. And so where were we going with RPE on this? Yeah, we have a lot of ways we can
go. Yeah. We were kind of, so the scattering was first bringing some context to that meme that you post, and we're putting it on YouTube so people can like watch that or see it if they don't go to your Instagram.
Yeah. I'll send it to you. You can drop it in on the video.
Perfect. Yeah, we'll do that. But the question is then like, why is like, first of all, let's talk about what RPE is. Like, where did we get it from? What's the scale of numbers that you use in your coaching? and for our listeners, just to give some grounding of what we're talking about in terms of RPE.
Yeah. Well, for RPE, in my coaching, obviously we have to choose anchor points because it can't just be, you know, a 10 out of 10 is a sprint and then 0 out of 10 is, you know, being asleep.
Right.
So we have to kind of find an anchor point for a common language. And so I typically use a 7 out of 10 as threshold, 8 out of 10 being just over threshold, but not max. And then, you know, 9 out of 10, 10 out of 10, that actually adds context because if somebody's doing like a really long FTP workout, they might get to a 9 or a 10. And at some points, a lot of points, I actually tell people not to go past an 8 out of 10 for any effort. Yep. And so it doesn't necessarily always correlate exactly to a power level, but, you know, it kind of has this multidimensional quality to it, because it has to do, well, because cycling obviously is multidimensional because we not only have, intensity and duration, there's also a third dimension of fatigue on top of that. And so everything kind of gets, you know, has its own context. And I think it's interesting actually that you said, like a threshold effort might be an 8 or a 9 because this is really just one of those things of a common language between a coach and a client where we just want to be able to, you know, have training communicated to us. And we also want to communicate certain things about training that we want the client to achieve. Right. 100%. So is that, I'm sure that's pretty much how you use it too, right?
Yeah. In fact, I was answering a question to an athlete yesterday about this in email, and instead of anchor point, I used hinge point, and it, you know, referred to the anaerobic or aerobic threshold, the, kind of that point over. And I was like, well, you know, so we could basically just have like two zones and then start to break up RPE, you know, based on that. And as long as you're on the same page of whatever the number means, I think most of us like in the field or say coaching virtually are using something from a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being a max effort, 1 being super easy or sitting on the couch, whatever, however you want to define it. But I think it's, again, yeah, that hinge point or the anchor points are really important to start to bring context. And I think the context is what is the most important part when you're coaching an athlete. One thing I'll say is like, this is also derived off of the Borg's scale that we used to use in like human performance labs and in more like research settings. And that was derived from what Borg found on heart rate using like a 6 to 20 scale. Am I right with that?
Yeah, it was 6 or 7 to 20. Actually, in his original paper on it, he actually cautioned that you don't parallel it too close to heart rate because he knew that at the time that heart rates were a little bit individualized. Yep, so even though a 16 out of 20 might for most people correlate to 160 BPM out of a 200 BPM max, that he knew that there was additional context and variability in people. Yep. So he actually cautioned in that paper, you know, don't use this too closely to heart rate parallel.
Yeah. So in what I mean by the heart rate parallel is choosing this number, you could then find a closely related heart rate by some mathematical calculation, right?
Right.
But there is, you know, fallacies with that. And so as we evolve using this scale of 1 to 10 to determine an effort is super important. Now back to your meme, it's like, you know, kind of this, like this brain that's not super active and you're using RPE and then you go to heart rate, and then you go to power and the brain is lighting up and then you go back to RPE and it's like, whoa, this is awesome. That's what you're talking about. And really without the hinge points or without the anchor points, that dead brain with RPE only is happening. But with all the hinge points, with all the anchor points, with all the context, now we have that enlightened brain. That's effectively what you're saying.
You know, that's last night I actually had an idea for a good, but not obviously not great metaphor for this, which is the actual temperature scales that we use, Fahrenheit and Celsius. Mm. Because, you know, the only temperature that we can actually really measure is like true zero. And then above that, it's like, who knows? Like we have to find anchor points to talk about temperature. Yeah. And so we use, you know, the most common element that we have, or not element, but the most common thing that we have on Earth, which is water. Mm-hmm. Well, besides nitrogen gas, I guess, is water. Anyway, so it's like we picked, you know, if the Celsius scale is nice and even, 0 degrees is the freezing point of water, 100 degrees is the boiling point of water. And that's great. Fahrenheit, little weird, 32 and 212. Okay, but we're still talking about the same thing. And so that's a good way to think about RPE and these anchor or hinge points, because physiologically, there is some phase change with this kind of stuff.
Yep. Yep. So, but why does it all matter? Like, if we got power meters now, why are we even using RPE?
You know, there's a lot of ways to use it. Obviously, as you know, as I know. Yeah. And so
yeah,
I think
just
actually
kind of the devil's advocate there, just been like, why are we using it? Why does it matter? Right.
I appreciate that. Yeah. I think probably the best use I can think of for RPE is figuring out if you are tired.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yep.
So if your usual numbers start to decouple from your usual RPE, that's a sign of, well, if they start feeling easier than normal, then it's like, oh, mm-hmm. I got to retest. I'm nice and fit. Mm-hmm. Or if they're feeling harder than normal, now you've got some decisions to make, because I think a lot of people might think, uh-oh, my numbers are going down. This is feeling harder. I need more training. Whereas people like us, well, most of the time, I would say 9 out of 10 times, say you probably need more rest. Mm-hmm. And so learning to read your legs is such a critical part of becoming a really successful athlete. And actually, one of the things that you mentioned to talk about today was Neil Vanderpool.
Yeah, Neil Vanderpool.
I was going to say, anybody named Vanderpool is probably a, you know, aerobic freak, and they should probably get signed by INEOS. All of them. If your name is Vanderpool, hit up INEOS. They will give you a contract.
Just
right
give
now.
You a gold medal right now. Your name is the, yes. Okay, gold medal. Yeah, next.
Because in his that long article that he wrote, I only got through about half of what he was talking about, but he's always talking about the limit.
Yeah.
And he's talking about RPE and other things that you can measure. But I searched actually in it how many times he mentions the limit, which he uses capital letters for.
I was just going to say he capitalizes it.
Ooh. Yeah.
And we'll.
Yeah, it's a very German thing, but it's also, you know, can be like a religious thing, like you capitalize God or he. And so just to emphasize the importance of it. And I think that actually has a lot of really cool implications, because he didn't actually explain it. Mm-hmm.
No,
but he talks about it.
Yeah. And, you know, I'd say let's get to Nils like a little bit afterwards. But to that point, when you capitalize a word like that, you're showing respect to it. You don't have to define it. Right. That's kind of the part. Like you say it's God capitalized. Right. OK, I get it. The limit, the edge, whatever you OK, respect. OK. So kind of coming back to perceived effort, because whether you're finding your limit or your edge or where that 10 is, right, you're giving respect to that, because that's where your body's at, right? And I find it, just like you said, to read your legs, it's an awareness tool, right?
Yep.
And having the perceived effort along with the power stamp or the heart rate stamp or whatever, that's the awareness tool that I try to instill in my athletes to let them know where they're at, where their freshness is on the day, where 200 watts is on the day, where 300 watts is, you know, where it's at. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, whether you're doing a long hill climb and you're creating more strain exponentially as you go with a longer interval, right? The perceived effort ticks up, even though you may be maintaining 200 watts the whole time, you get more tired, just like you said. In a criterium, you're not using your power meter to gauge effort, right? You got to know you're putting out effort. You're doing the race. However, throughout the whole time period, as you are aware of the race settings and the corner and the person next to you and all this kind of stuff, and aware of your own fatigue, you got to be able to make those decisions based on perceived effort. And this is where we're going with it. The goal is not to stare at the power meter. The goal is not to stare at the heart rate monitor. The goal is to check it with the awareness tool that is RPE.
Yeah, it's a feedback loop.
That's it.
Yep.
Cool. I like where that's at. And in the spirit of not drilling super deep, Coley, we're moving on.
All right, let's go.
But it's adjacent too, because I'm kind of setting you up. This question, I think it was from an athlete's wife. And it was like, because we were talking about perceived effort and some of the in zone two and all this, which we'll talk about. But it was like, well, why do we have training zones anyway then? Like if you have all these power meters that read differently and heart rate monitors and everybody's heart rate's a little bit, why have training zones? Why not just use RPE? And I was like, huh, that's pretty good. Pretty good question, actually. So, Coley, to you, why do we even have training zones?
Well, it's the same thing as we have RPE. Yeah. We want to be able to describe, prescribe, or communicate how hard we're going. You know, because before it's like everybody used speed or lap times or something like that. That has a big place, certainly, especially in timed and distance type events. But you know, in cycling, it's so much more open and free unless you're on a velodrome all the time. So using power zones, I think Andy Coggin has said many times, and you've probably heard this too, were originally meant to be descriptive, not prescriptive.
Yeah. Yep.
And so, because I think, you know, Andy comes from the day where you would have certain types of rides. You know, you would go out to do an endurance ride or like a tempo or a group ride, or you would do a, you know, threshold ride, or you would do just some max efforts up some hills or sprints or whatever. And then he was like, okay, now you come home, you look at the power data and you figure out what you did.
So yeah. Can you tell our listeners, what do you mean by descriptive versus prescriptive?
Right. So descriptive means a post hoc analysis tool. And so you go out and you do the thing as you normally would, and then you look at the thing afterwards. Yeah. And this is kind of how I actually prescribe most VO2 max efforts, because I just assign them as max and people go do them. And then I look at the power and the pacing and everything. And 9 times out of 10, absolutely nail it. 1 out of 10 times, something to tweak. But it's a post hoc tool. It's not, you need to ride 5 minutes at 330 watts. It's you need to go max. And then we will look at our tools later and see how effective this is being.
Gosh, I'm so glad you brought that up, because this is also something that I've been trying to communicate to my athletes in terms of like, here's the ranges on the day, and say they go out and they even like super crush it. Maybe went a little over, maybe it was like just hanging on to it. It's like, no, that's fine, because we're still on the edges of that. We're still developing threshold, whatever we're trying to do, VO2. But yet, the human being has ranges themselves on the day. Sometimes you come in and you're like, man, I feel like superhuman, superman, superwoman, whatever. Other days you're like, I'm like Eeyore, man. I just got to get through this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's, it's helpful too because I assign so much stuff by RPE rather than a power target, because like a power target can also, you know, for us coaches, it can actually come to bite us in the end, because if we give our client a certain power target and they're not quite recovered, we didn't know that they didn't eat enough last night, they didn't sleep well, whatever it is, if they can't do it, now we've got to start thinking about, oh, why couldn't they do this? Why did I assign this too high, or why was it too low? Maybe it wasn't quite an effective workout. And so especially when you start assigning things like intermittent efforts, like if you assign somebody like 2x20 of 15 seconds on, 15 seconds off, how do you prescribe that? Yep. Is it 120% of FTP, 150, 200? And different people can do different, different intensities with this kind of stuff. So I'll tell them, if somebody wants to do VO2 max efforts and they insist on having a power target, which happens sometimes, and that's okay. I'll give them what I think they can maintain. And then I'll say, do the first two efforts like this. Yes. And then I want you to push it a little more for the last, whatever, 2, 3, 4 efforts. Yep. And then you can see just how much you can go with this. And that's also a good way to measure performance afterwards too. You use power as a target as a starting point, but then you can use whatever power you did as a post hoc analysis tool of, okay, now you did these efforts 3 weeks ago and you did 330 watts. This week you did 345 watts for these. So we see progress.
Yep. Yeah. And that's a beautiful way to queue up someone's like first VO2, because they're like, what is a 10? And there's a lot of anxiety that goes on with VO2 max efforts, 5x5, 5x4, whatever it is.
Oh, I'm sure you've got athletes too, and I do as well, who have more anxiety for either a VO2 max session, their first one of the season or whatever, or like, just a regular fitness test, than they ever had for like the SATs or the LSATs or whatever.
It's bonkers. Yeah, it really is. And it's let's dial this down a little. We're just going out there and doing a little bit of work on the bike.
Exactly.
But, to that point, the descriptive versus prescriptive, it's good for all coaches out there to listen, and even a reminder of yourself. Cause when we're building, you know, we've kind of gotten to a point where, you know, a lot of this, say automation that goes on with, building, training programs, whether it's static or dynamic or custom or whatever, we're bringing context. We're using these tools that we've, you know, in Coggin in particular, have really helped to define and shape up with training zones. But as we prescribe them and kind of tell the athlete what to do, both like in words and typing or, you know, on the phone, and then they go out and do it, that athlete still looks at that number and is like, oh, coach said 60, I got to go above 60%. I got to hold on to it. So your first 5-hour ride, and it's an endurance miles ride of 60 to 76%. And they're at 4 hours and 30 minutes, like, oh, just like reaching for 60%, kind of missing the point.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, they are. Well, I think that's a way that, you know, using training zones prescriptively mm-hmm. can actually come to bite us as well.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so a lot of the time when you have somebody go ride, I've had countless athletes who have done endurance rides too hard, and they've done it like that for years. Mm-hmm. And you know, I've had a lot of clients come to me, amateur and professional both, who have said, something's not going right. Can you help? And the first thing I do is I tell them, put your computer in your back pocket.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one.
Go ride to feel. And so many people at levels that you wouldn't believe, well, Adam, you would believe, but mm-hmm. the listeners, you might not believe, the level that this goes up to.
It's pretty remarkable. I mean, we could talk at length even about what goes on mentally to have that happen, right? Whereas where I work with the athlete too, is if I have an athlete there where they get heady about those numbers, I'm just like, just disassociate from it. The number means nothing, right? And then they say, well, why measure it at all? It's like, measure everything so that we can be descriptive afterwards, because we want to know what's working in the long run. So we need the numbers. However, when it's getting to the point where it's causing all this stress and all this anxiety, then we'd have to put it to bed. So that's pocket or change the screen, whatever tape we used to do when you couldn't, you know, customize screens and stuff. So,
yeah. Yeah, I think that works really well. Oh, never mind. I had a thought and I completely forgot it. So
no, so training zones, still a thing, still need them. And, you know, they are the anchor points and hinge points to go along with RPE. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like if you think that the power number is everything, and I you know, back in like what, 2013, I was like this too. Like, I was like, heart rate doesn't matter. I didn't wear a heart rate monitor for years. I looking back on it, I wish I had. I would have so much better data about my aerobic fitness back then, which was not great, but you know, I would know what it was. You know, I just thought the power number was everything, and mm-hmm. that as long as you hit X watts, you are getting Y adaptation. And that's actually not really the case. There's so many ways to elicit different types of adaptation in the body that, you know, using power numbers really, and, you know, riding to the same like RPE over, you know, like I've got athletes who get up in their head about their threshold number mm-hmm. all the time. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the time I'll actually tell people to go do their threshold efforts blind. Mm-hmm. Just to take power off your screen, put tape over it, whatever it is. Watch your lap time, but push what, you know, threshold feels like. And then we'll look at the numbers, and they're always really good or better than expected afterwards.
Usually better with a moderately trained athlete, for sure. And I'm glad you brought that up, because one thing I wanted to mention about perceived effort and pertains to training zones here is pacing. Like, pacing is super crucial, right? And so whether it is time trialing or, you know, kind of endurance long haul or whatever it is that number alone, the power number anyway, or even the heart rate number, that's not going to get you a great pace. It has to coalesce with effort as you go. Mm-hmm. So pacing is critical.
Absolutely.
You mentioned threshold. So I'll just kind of segue to number three, because this is also, I get this question every year, but it is, you know, my FTP is this number right now. How much can my FTP increase in one season?
Oh boy.
I love giving Coley these really specific questions with no context. It's like my favorite thing to do. Because I know exactly where his brain is right now. But
I'm like a wind-up toy.
You really are. Yeah, you really are.
Okay, so
you guys should just go on YouTube and watch what he's doing right now. It's awesome.
Yeah. Man, and I've gotten this question from prospective clients, yeah, and current clients, of course, and just friends. Yeah, I'm sure you do too. And the answer is we don't know until we try.
Yeah.
And it's like one of my clients is actually several clients that have just a ton of power. Like their average FTP is like 390 when they're untrained, you know? And you kind of train them in a certain way if you think they're at their ceiling of potential. Mm-hmm. And you train them a very different way if you think that they have room to grow. And I'm not convinced anybody is really at their potential until we try to get them more fit, to try to get them more aerobic capacity or more, you know, time trial endurance or whatever it is, you know, sprint watts, take your pick. We don't know until we try. And that especially goes for FTP because FTP is highly correlated to aerobic capacity and endurance and, you know, like 9,000 different things that we can name, like in terms of physiology. And so, you know, actually I have a similar question. It's like, if you're doing an FTP test, like one of mine, like a long one that, you know, is mostly by RPE, mm-hmm, and you figure out what threshold feels like and you look at the number, right? I've been wondering this little thought exercise. Do you have to go over it to be sure that you were at it? Do you have to go over FTP, mm-hmm, to be sure that you are at FTP at the lower number? And I think the answer might be yes. Mm-hmm. It's, well, for me anyway.
I think so. Just to answer your question right now, because again, it's the limit, right? It's the edge. And
with the capital L.
Yeah. And so what I always, my term has always been the edge, right? And I capitalize the E because the analogy I use is you don't know where the edge is until you go find it. Meaning you go up to it and you look over, right? Mm-hmm. You look over, but then you're like, ooh, 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 back. Because yeah, finding the edge is not any benefit in this context, in the metaphor. It's not beneficial if you just jump over it, right? Then there's, yep, you can't live to tell the story. So you find, yep, the edge, so you have to go over, but then dial it back. And so I think, right, from a metaphorical standpoint, as well as actual standpoint, when you're out there on the road doing something, you got to go a little over it to answer it.
And so to bring that back to how much FTP can you gain in a year, you don't know until you try to go over that edge. Yeah. Is your FTP actually 250 watts? Like, is that as much potential as you have? Or if you change up your training or you add more rest or you try to add more volume, like if you manipulate some factor, does that get you more aerobic improvement? You don't know until you try. And there are also ways to see if you are, you know, aerobically kind of stagnant, as it were, like plateaued, maintaining. Mm-hmm. And if that's on purpose, if you don't have more time to train, if you're too stressed off the bike, whatever it is, that's okay too. But you know, if you, I've seen people gain 80 watts of threshold in a year. It's their first year, mm-hmm, to be sure, mm-hmm, but they've done it. I've also seen people gain 10 watts in a year. And for somebody who's highly developed, gaining 10 watts in a year can be a huge victory.
Yep. Yeah. And so to that point, I'd say for those who go do a group ride and they figure out they're riding next to a coach and they ask them this question, just so you know, ahead of time, is the less trained you are, the more you can gain in your FTP in the season and for pretty much everything else. The more well-trained you are, the less that percentage or amount of wattage you will gain in that year. So those are some of the kind of contextual points. And to the point of like, if you're kind of coming off the couch and say you start working with a coach and you do a field test, I've seen people, you know, up to, I think Coley said like 80 watts. I've seen up to like 20-25% increase. Okay.
Yep.
And saying going from like 200 probably up to around 245, 250, something like that.
That's huge.
Yeah. Sort of increase in somebody who's not well trained. And that's pretty normal, right? Because, mm-hmm, the glycolytic energy system and training at threshold is some of the most trainable stuff that you can do in a human body. And so, you know, that's the good news. you know, the bad news is if you're close to your genetic potential, you know, the gains get, you know, smaller at the top. So it's, this question is hilarious. I mean, it's a good question, but it's also hilarious because everybody always asks it, and there's just so much to get the answer. There's so much context that needs to be had.
And, so. and not only that, it also depends on who you are, like genetically, which is not up to you. I mean, totally. Every cyclist at the top level or at pretty much any level has put in a ton of hard work.
Yep.
And some can improve really quickly and, you know, keep that improvement up year to year. Some improve at a slow and steady rate, and some it's like pulling teeth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's okay.
And it's also, I mean, just straight up, I'm going to tell everybody, it's also what you're willing to give up, right? Yeah. Like, are you only going to train 10 hours a week, or are you going to train 20, or can you train 30? Like, do you need to train 30? You know, there's a lot of time that can go into that answer as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I actually, you know, I think, one of my empirical cycling coaches is always talking about her, swimming background, mm-hmm. and how hard the coaches would push people back then. And you know, she was saying that her high school swimming coach had said, your genetics don't matter. It's how much hard work that you put in that matters, which is both true. And it's also a bold-faced lie. Mm-hmm. Because like one of my very hardest working clients has a threshold of you know, about 200 watts. And he has some of the best endurance, you know, relative to his threshold.
And how big is he?
And he has, you know, his average size, mm-hmm. like 65, 70 kilos. And so, you know, he's not going to be on the world tour, but he works as hard or harder than anybody. And you know, it's one of those things where there are certain things in your genetics and in your body and in your, you know, mental makeup and in your physical makeup and in your genetic makeup that can say, all right, we're going to give you as much endurance ability as we can at your, you know, albeit low aerobic capacity. Mm-hmm. And I honestly like working with somebody like that as much as I like working with somebody with a 440 watt FTP.
Yeah. I mean, where my brain was just going there is like, I've always said, whether I'm running a team, building a team, coaching an athlete, whatever it is, I would much rather work with somebody who's a good hard worker and has a lower VO2 rather than the, you know, 85 VO2 that can't get out of their way when it comes to organizing their life. Honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's like picking people on your team. You'd rather have the person who's
for sure
fun to hang out with, yep. and who's got a good head in a race, yep. rather than that person who, like, you know, takes the flyer 3 laps to go and gets caught every single time. It's like, take the flyer if you need to, if that's part of the team strategy, fine. But like, if you just like yeet off the front, just
ridiculous. Yeah, for sure.
Anyway.
For sure. Okay. We'll kind of digress a little bit off the training spectrum and then swing back to it. But here's another kind of question I've been getting a lot is, coach, should I get the Oura ring or the Whoop strap? What are your thoughts there, Coley?
I have very few thoughts because I always confuse the Oura ring with birth control.
Either way, just answer how you best can.
Although, to be fair, if you're wearing an Oura ring, no, I'm just kidding. Might act like that anyway. I'm just kidding. I'm seriously kidding. You know, it's for like what, HRV tracking, sleep tracking, stuff like that. You know, I've been doing some digging into HRV with a research group lately, and one of the things that we find is that the quality of the strap and the heart rate measurement matters a lot, because algorithms that calculate these things on top are complex. And if you have a weird heart rate detection, or like if you have an ectopic beat or something like that, like all these algorithms can get thrown off. So the first thing you need to do is look at what is the quality of the heart rate data that I'm getting here.
Yeah.
You know, because I would say most people should probably sleep with a 6 lead EKG, but not everybody's actually going to do that. So
do you sleep with that?
No, I would get kicked out of bed. So, you know, so I think, you know, the other thing that people are looking for with this stuff is they're looking to track their recovery, right? Mm-hmm. So I think if you can use it as a tool, because you know it's the same thing that that you know Nils van der Poel was talking about. He measures a lot of stuff, but not to the point of driving himself insane, and he uses it in a certain way. But he has a method that works for him.
Yeah.
And he's not a slave to anything in particular, and he uses how he's feeling above all. But it's like when you need to, if you suspect you're like getting sick, or you suspect you're a little overtrained or something like that, you can use HRV data from a Whoop or an Oura Ring to help triangulate on something. But you should not, I don't think you should train to it. You know, you shouldn't have this thing as a training master. Like how you're feeling should be the number one thing. Like you might have your HRV in the tank one day and you're feeling great and you get on the bike and you have a great workout and it's like, oh, what happened there? I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Yep. So what do you think? Should people get it? Do you make your athletes get one?
No, I do not. I do not hold my athletes down and force them to purchase anything directly.
Likewise.
Like that.
Would you recommend it to your athletes typically?
I have recommended it to athletes and full disclosure, I am wearing an Oura Ring.
Are you sponsored by them?
Not sponsored by them.
All right. Hit Adam up. He would like a sponsorship.
Special code, Coach Coley for the discount. I used to be a little bit more hot on it than I am now. I will admit, I liked the technology. I liked the way it operated versus Whoop, where there wasn't a subscription based their way of measuring HRV at night versus a certain point during the day or during a workout that Whoop used to do. I don't know if they still do. Made more sense based on the literature I was reading when it comes down to extrapolating the information that you want to get from HRV, which is the system recovered or is it not? Right. And for the endurance community, I think that's why a lot of people, that's one of the primary reasons why we want HRV and we're in the Oura Ring. I think my observations of it, because I've been on it for a year and a half, almost 2 years now, Gen 2 to Gen 3.
And still no kids. No, sorry.
It's still no kids. It's an incredible thing. but what I've seen is that it brings great awareness to your sleeping habits. So in terms of, and when it all is kind of like coming together here somehow by picking all these random topics, but rate of perceived effort, training zones, and what we're trying to achieve, right? A sleeping thing that quantifies how much sleep you're getting can help you determine how much total sleep you're getting somewhat accurately, how much like time and zone you're sleeping or getting, and then how to optimize getting more sleep. And here's quickly how to do it. Say you go to sleep at midnight and you get in 8 hours of sleep, but the deep sleep is lacking. What is suggested is to go to bed earlier. So then you go to bed at 10. You get 8 hours of sleep. You wake up a little earlier, right? But you get in a good amount of deep sleep and REM sleep and all these other things. Well, cool. Now I've just, you know, biohacked myself. Great. But it doesn't, that, great phrase, but yeah. The problem with a lot of these wearables is it, everything that that I find anyway, with my athletes and with myself, goes back to what we already knew. Get 8 hours of sleep, go to bed somewhere between 9 and 10, typically get more sleep if you can. Don't drink a bunch, especially like before bed. Don't do a bunch of, you know, work before bed, put work away, no screens, all this kind of, the more you can do that, the more sleep and quality sleep you tend to get. Now, when it comes to HRV, I'm all over the place, man. There's coaches that are like,
I know exactly where you were going with this. I was going right there, which is, having HRV for a well-trained athlete or even a moderately trained aerobic athlete. You know, if you're like just off the couch, you know, I think, or you're a recreationally active person who's got a busy life and whatnot, you know, I think a lot of people just want to be told what to do, and that's fine. I understand that. I want to just be told what to do when it comes to so many aspects of my life, because I'm just so tired all the time when I'm done with work and training and everything. So sure. I understand that. But for people who are, you know, moderately trained to highly trained, by that we can just say if you've been doing aerobic training for a couple times a week for a couple months, right? At that point, HRV actually seems to react a lot more to what happens when you're not training than whatever you're doing in training, unless you're way overdoing it. In which case, you know, we have other metrics that we can look at to say, okay, you're overdoing it. But HRV does seem to react a lot more to, are you drinking? Are you spending too much time on your screens? Things like that. It'll make you think about the quality of your sleep and the quality of, you know, life, just in terms of stress and everything. So it seems to, for people who have that kind of stuff on lock, it's probably really not going to do much for you. But if you need something to tell you, hey, you didn't get great sleep last night, this is probably going to affect you and your mood or your training or whatever it is. If not today, then next week, next month, because it always catches up. If this is something that's going to help you look at that and, you know, get better sleep hygiene, or, you know, not have that extra beer or glass of wine with dinner, this is something that can be very beneficial.
Exactly. And I think that having more awareness and a little bit more accountability to some of those healthy habits, I think it's great. So that's why, you know, when I say I pick up a new athlete and we start talking and all this kind of stuff, and they say, what should I get? Whatever I tell them is going to be born out of what I observe in their habits and their awareness or lack thereof, and yep, their openness to technology and all this stuff. So it just, that part depends. But back to HRV real quick, because I do not change training at all based on an HRV number.
Same.
And because I've seen it super low, trending low and super low, and have good days. I've seen it high and trending high and not have good days and have good days. I've seen it medium and have good days or bad days. So it's there's so many other variables at play in the human physiology and psychology that an HRV number, and I'm sorry for those who are super in love with it and all this kind of stuff, like it is not strong enough of a thing for me to do anything with it other than observe it for now, track it over time, and see if I can find changes or trends.
Yep. Yeah, the body's much more complex.
It is. Yep, it is. And I will say too, like you can drive your HRV down a lot with intensity, just like grind yourself out. In stress, strain in general, you can do it with drinking. You can do it with like relational stress. Like I've seen it, right? And you can drive it down. Eventually it'll catch up to you. However, I think that also if, you know, you can compartmentalize and do all, and the way to do it is if you do a hard block of training or racing or whatever and do good habits and take care of yourself, it'll go down, 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 but you can still perform. And that's what I want everybody to realize or grasp is if you do all these other things really good, but you're seeing this one thing say bad, doesn't really matter because it's not that strong of a corollary.
And I've seen it actually have the opposite with people. The more tired they get, the better their HRV looks. Then as soon as they get a rest day, it just tanks.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's so super weird. Still not there yet. I still subscribe to measure many good things, and then even if we don't know it at the time, whether it's worth it or not, but it's pretty cool to measure. And if you're into data, if you're not into the numbers and it just kind of stresses you out anyway, don't add it. Okay, so we've talked about him. We mentioned him a few times. The internet, I wouldn't say the internet is breaking over Nils van der Poel. However, endurance community, it's been pretty buzzy and hot. I've had a lot of people text me and talk to me, and I even did a podcast with Jason Koop. We talked a little bit about Nils. Those who don't know him, I don't know, you didn't watch the Olympics, but Nils van der Poel, he's a Swedish speed skater in long distance, and he won 2 gold medals in the 5K and 10K. He set Olympic and world records, and he's a badass, straight up.
Yep.
So the reason why we're talking about him is for many reasons, but he's the more I read about him, he's super cool dude. I kind of want to meet this guy and just hang out because of his character. But also he won. And for those who also don't know, speed skating, the Dutch are like Ineos. Okay. They have all the money. They have all the people. They have all the whatever talent. Sweden, they're pretty good. You know, the Nordic Nordic country. They meddle a lot and all this, but not as good as the Dutch. So there's this battle there. But yet Niels wins the medals and beats the Dutch. And they're like, well, blah, blah, blah. How did, you know, you're not all that good. You know, that's not the right term. But he's like, well, here's how I did it. Boom. And he does his 63-page manifesto stating how he trained for this Olympic cycle, what he did, why he did it. And then he goes off on some of this like philosophical pontification of sorts on nutrition, alcohol, and then how to break down, how to skate a 10K, which is the title of this thing. And he does that after he wins, right? So it's not only like, boom, set all the records, dropped everybody, wins the medal, but he's like, and here's how I did it. So go ahead, you can do it and come get me if you want. But here's what happened and here's how I did it. And it is like mad respect to that guy for the performance as well as the here's what I did. And to frame it up a little bit, Coley got through half of it, but because I give this to him yesterday, mind you, less than 24 hours ago, and he still has a full-time job and a relationship and he has better things to do than read 63 pages that I sent him on text message. But the context is the guy trained his butt off like 30 to 35, I think up to 38 hour weeks. And he did it with a 5-2, meaning he trained 5 days a week and took the weekends off. Okay. And that is abnormal in terms of a rhythm for people, but the volume is fairly normal for, an Olympic aerobic sort of athlete. So based on what you read, Coley, and his kind of methods and systems, what are some of your initial thoughts of like, you know, should the endurance athlete be freaking out about this as well? Or what are some of your thoughts initially?
Well, he made a mistake publishing it because now I know exactly how to beat him.
Perfect. Coley 2026 or whatever that year is going to be.
I don't even know how to skate. But I will soon. Cause he told me how to do it.
He taught you how to skate a 10K. So
yeah, now I just have to ride, you know, I just have to do 90 minutes at 400 watts 5 days a week
and 7 hours of aerobic building after that.
Oh my God. I mean, you know, the guy has an amazing capacity to both work and recover.
Yeah, that's it.
I don't coach any professional athletes who could maintain that training schedule. Yep. None. Yep. But, you know, it seems like he found it based on what worked for him and based on, you know, decent, actually good fundamental training principles.
Yeah, really good.
But, you know, it's not one of those things where everybody can look at what he did and go, oh yeah, that's how it's done, of course. Because obviously the Dutch don't train like that. And they're still winning medals. Mm-hmm. He beat the pants off everybody in the 10K, but you know, he didn't beat the pants off everybody that much in the 5K. Mm-hmm. But you know, 10K, 12-ish minutes. You know, that's a good combination. It's mostly aerobic capacity, so big VO2 max, and so all of the endurance riding really helps support that kind of thing. It's, you know, that's good. And actually, you know, it's funny because one of the things that that I've done with a lot of my professional athletes who have never really done good targeted training in terms of like physiological systems, they've done a ton of volume, but they haven't done good quality VO2 max work and good quality threshold work a lot of the time. And so as soon as we do it, we see the aerobic capacity jump hugely mm-hmm. in the course of, you know, a couple of weeks after they've, you know, gotten ready to do that kind of thing. And so, you know, this kind of thing is a lot like how I schedule periodization for my athletes, except, you know, I think he has an advantage in some ways in that, you know, his competitions are, you know, they're not anything like a cycling competition calendar.
Yeah. Yep.
And not only that, they're shorter. And, you know, he has a lot of luxury in terms of, you know, his ability to recover and train.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. And, you know, I'll get into what I liked about the training side of it. But my straight up criticism in terms of applying this to, like, say, cycling or something else is, he even notes this in his paper, is like, this is how he did it for skating a 5 and 10K, which is essentially a short time trial, not a mass
start. Or a long pursuit.
Or a long pursuit, right? It's not a mass start. He's like, if it's mass start, stuff changes. You can't do this, right? Yeah. Because of the dynamic aspect of it, whereas the 5 and 10K more controlled, okay? And so keep that in mind for all those listeners who now want to do a 5 and 2 and do 30 hours of volume, okay? So yes, to everything that Coley said, like, the structure of it is great. The rhythm of it is unique with the 5 and 2. However, he found that worked for him, and it allowed him to stay more motivated, because having 2 days completely off to hang out with friends and socialize and whatever, that kept him going, and his stoke was high on Monday. But to Coley's point, that's pretty, you know, a lot of training in 5 days. So it's genetically very gifted. Motivation was there. And you know, his overall progression and build was very sound. I mean, a lot of aerobic capacity. Then he shifted into some, what we, you know, would call like threshold. And then when it was time, he got very specific and he skated fast, and he trained to do that. He also broke down his race very systematically in terms of the speed times per lap of what he would have to skate in order to achieve a world record, in order to win gold. And then he executed on it, like, straight up. So, I mean, like, the structure of everything is great. How he went about it was amazing. And there was, you know, obviously, and I'm not sitting here like trying to pull it apart. What I'm trying to do here is have a conversation about, people are super excited about it. Now a champion did it. So now they want to do it. Right.
Yep.
And what would you say to that, Coley? Everybody wanting to do a 5 and 2.
You know, I've experimented with that kind of stuff with some athletes, and you have to be super, super, super well trained to do like 3 days of hard work in a row, mm-hmm. much less 4 or 5.
Right.
And just 2 days of recovery, like, nobody on my roster could do that. And I would imagine very few people in the world could do that.
Yeah, because keep in mind, like, these 5 days, you know, again, 30 to 38 hours. So we're talking 4 at the minimum, 8 at the maximum hours per day in a row of riding, running. And he didn't do that much skating in the off season. But anyway, so just to frame this up for people who haven't read this thing yet. So anyway, sorry, Coley.
Yeah. Well, I think actually one of the other things that this article does a good job of explaining to some degree is the amount of technique involved in speed skating.
It's actually really cool. I knew nothing really about that. So that's it. This is cool.
Yeah. I had been kind of fascinated by speed skaters for a little while, kind of like I'm fascinated by Olympic weightlifters, or just weightlifters if you want to be pedantic about it. I know there's people out there. Sorry. I know it's just called weightlifting.
Okay.
That's all right. So I think, you know, the thing with something like that is that we don't really have that kind of ability in cycling to manage splits and whatnot. But also in cycling, I'm going to say it, there's not a lot of technique involved. Unless you are racing off-road or like trials or something like that, there's not a ton of technique. Mm-hmm. It's unique to, well, it's not unique. It's actually, yeah, I think it's unique to cycling in that there's not much technique involved. Because mm-hmm. in a lot of sports, you know, a good active recovery, moderate recovery, kind of easy day is like technique work.
Yep.
And we don't really have the need to do that in cycling unless, you know, coaching somebody for cyclocross or mountain bike, in which case, okay, cool. Skills day, go off road, keep it kind of chill, you know, work on drops or whatever it is you want to work on. Yep. And so, you know, so when it comes to him skating at speed, you know, the technique in terms of corners and, you know, everything it's really fascinating to compare with cycling, because that's the kind of thing where, like, if I want to improve, or if I want to train somebody for a pursuit, let's say like a long pursuit, let's say a 5 or 6K pursuit, you know, 5, 6 minute effort, I would train them the same way as like regular pursuit, but there are two different sessions I would have them be doing on the bike as we get closer to competition. The first would be a straight up VO2 max workout, which would be all out. I don't care about your pacing. You just go start hard and you keep it hard. The goal is improving aerobic capacity, you know, to build on all that base that we've put into you so far. The other one would be a race specific workout. Now we're trying to gain the most speed. And so, you know, that's one of the things that I noticed he wasn't really doing, because, you know, if you're skating whatever, you know, fast, hard efforts that you're doing, like, to him, that's probably good VO2 max work. But, you know, to me, you know, somebody like him, they can do it. Not everybody can have great VO2 max work done like that, kind of evenly paced, somewhat submaximal. But he's done so much other stuff. It's kind of hard to tease out. You know what I mean?
For sure. And that's actually like a really, that's a point that I wasn't necessarily going to bring up here, but it was kind of a question mark to me too, because he said like in his last couple of years, he didn't do too much what he called VO2 work. Right? And what I understood by that was the limit, right? The maximum stuff, because he's like, yeah, it's too hard to recover from, right? But he kind of hung his hat on like, I'm the skater that skated the most 30 second laps. Mm-hmm. From what I understand, again, we're hacks here when it comes to speed skating. I have no nothing, for sure. But from the context I do know, it's a pretty fast lap. But to him, it was somewhat race pace, but tolerable to the point where it was like high threshold for him. So it wasn't overly taxing to the point where he couldn't come back and do it again the next day, because he clearly did. He did so many of those, but that got his timing down. That was the race specificity. And he knew that he could skate, I think it was like 260 laps at 30 seconds in a week. Okay, solid. Now all I got to do is start chipping it down from there when I'm halfway through in order to achieve a world record. That's it. In that process, like, I respect the process of breaking that down. That is so cool.
Yeah. And also, I really liked how he mentioned that he felt like certain off ice techniques and like skating slower, all that kind of stuff, would actually disrupt his technique from skating at speed.
That's the other unique point, right? So he doesn't strength train. He doesn't do the slide board. He doesn't.
Although he was already very strong.
For sure. But yeah, and he did some, and he nods to that too. He did slide board. He did strength training before, but in this, you know, then he was a speed skater, young, developed. So he had a lot of ice time. After Pyeongchang, he was in the army for a year and then came back and kind of had this new way of kind of doing things. So keep in mind, folk, like, anytime this is the Anders Ericsson sort of thing, is he had a lot of hours in the bank before he did this latest thing too. So you can't overlook those elements. Okay.
Yeah,
before he did this like Rocky Balboa Swedish speed skating sort of training regimen.
Yeah. Punching, you know, beef carcasses and whatnot.
Right. Right.
Cause I'm sure that's how you train for boxing.
Running through the fields, chasing things. I don't know. So to kind of bring this thing back, like, oh, first, before we kind of bring this home, because we're right at an hour and I promised myself we wouldn't go too far. The last thing I'll say is this guy's also a prankster and a jokester. He has fun. He has a section on alcohol, which you should read. And he's like, you know what? I didn't deny myself a beer every once in a while. And sometimes I needed 8 beers. And whatever kept me happy, that was fine. Yeah. So and he writes like this, and it's great. Not only that, I found a New York Times article. I'm going to link to it in this so everybody can read in this quick read. It's not 63 pages, but it talked about how he and a Swedish friend stole a fish before the Olympics, dead fish. And they went in, they put it between the mattress and the box spring of some Dutch speed skaters and duct taped it like this.
Oh God.
And it just like reeked and everything. And he and the Dutch were like complaining. They're like, no, it was the Norwegians. They did this, blah, blah, blah. And so, and then he's like, and then so it came out that it was actually him. And they asked him, like, why he did it? He's like, because it was funny. And so even though that there's this battle royale between, you know, the Swedes and the Dutch, or everybody in the Dutch and speed skating, he has a good time with it too. You know, and this is when I'm looking at what creates a champion: train hard, rest well, have fun along the way, and let's win some gold medals. And that's why I think, that's why I want to talk about this. The guy's a champ for sure. But what you don't do, what he did. It was his process and in what he found to be successful. However, what we can take away from it is, you know, he found what worked for him. He developed a lot of aerobic capacity. He changed the training to be more specific or developed energy systems along the way, got specific during race season, and used these cues, call it rate of perceived effort or awareness tools along the way, and challenged his coach to refine the process as he went in order to achieve what he wanted to achieve. And I think if there's anything that you get when you read the 63-page thing, it is that. It is not that you need to drink 8 beers a night and do 38 hours of training.
And you also need to put dead animals in the beds of your opponents. Don't actually do that. You know, because I was just thinking, if that were me, like a cycling equivalent might be like somebody cutting your brake cables on your bike the night before a race. Ooh. And now you've got to bring it to a shop and you've got that level of stress, like, cause that can hugely impact somebody's like peak performance, is that level of stress. And so,
I think he did it like before the opening games. I think.
Okay. So, all right. If it was, as long as it was before the Olympics, that's okay. If it was actually during the Olympics, that's really shitty.
Yeah. I think it was like, a few days ahead. I don't know to be sure, but yeah, good point, Coley. Hopefully he didn't do that like the night before.
Hopefully not. Oh God.
Oh my gosh. But that would be a good, that's like, anyway, I won't go there. I was going to say that's a good war tactic.
It's the Norwegian Godfather thing.
Here you go. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Gosh. Well, Coley, we're going to wrap it up here right at the top of the hour. Thanks to Coley of Empirical Cycling for joining us today to talk about some current events in the endurance world.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Trainwright Podcast. We hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure to visit our website at trainwright.com/podcast, where you can find social links, bonus content, and more about CTS. Go ahead and subscribe to the podcast so you'll never miss a show, and leave us a rating on iTunes. Until next time, train hard, train smart, train right.